Coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report shows Oregon's corporate tax rate has dropped like a stone and is now the lowest in the nation.
The first meeting by state environmental regulators on air quality has grassroots activists worried.
And the first ever Oregon State Cannabis Growers Fair opens at the fairgrounds in Salem this August. We'll speak with the organizers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 29th, 2016. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Once again, the city of Portland has an expensive problem with a new computer system, this time with a new automated permit software. City officials cut ties with the lead contractor, Sierra Cedar Incorporated, after the Georgia-based company failed to complete half its promised work by the end of a three-year-old contract. Of the $3.5 million the city has spent so far, more than half went to Sierra Cedar's fees and travel expenses. City Councilor Dan Salzman, who oversees the Bureau of Development Services, said it's an amicable parting of ways. Both parties agreed not to sue each other. Officials had once hoped to complete the project by May of 2015. The new target date is November of 2018. Other problematic city computer problems have included the Water Bureau software in 2000 that left the city with millions in uncollected bills and a payroll system that tripled in cost to $47.4 million in 2010.
The Oregon State Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority today held its first technical work group meeting in its, quote, Cleaner Air Oregon campaign. State officials said earlier this year the process is intended to create, quote, health-based standards, unquote, to evaluate and regulate toxic air emissions across the state. This work group meeting has been flagged by officials as the first step in that process. KBOO spoke with Mary Pevedo of Neighbors for Clean Air as she sat at the work group meeting this afternoon.
What's at stake is whether our state is going to use this moment in time, use this, you know, broad referendum of its people to say that we want to be the best in the nation at protecting public health from toxic air emissions. And so what's at stake is, are we going to do a, you know, implement the absolute best program we can do to achieve that goal, or are we going to allow this to get mired in process and, you know, stakeholder and, you know, kind of the historical Oregon way of coming out with a less than satisfactory outcome.
What is your sense of how it's going so far?
You know, there's a lot of red flags already for us in this process. Membership of the committee is, this technical work group especially, is still problematic. We do believe that while we understand that there's a lot of expertise at the table and people with, you know, experience in regulating, experience in working within government, you know, that is required to regulate, and experience in industry in complying with regulations, there is still missing an objective outside public interest voice that talks about the realm of the possible, not always of just what's been practicably applied previously. And so we're concerned that there are not people that, you know, represent objective expertise that are outside of governmental systems already. And so that's sort of our first red flag. We were also concerned there are white papers for every single category that they are addressing in this process. And again, this technical work group, we were told, was not intended at all to deal with policy decisions. They're here to deal with the technical capabilities of an air emissions program. Yet there's a lot of language that really still deviates from the how to the whether or not we should do that. In fact, you pulled this out in the middle of this meeting today, and there was about 40 minutes that really a lot of the people at the table were talking about the economic impacts of decisions. And I really feel like that's the conversation that needs to happen later in the process when the advisory committee, the stakeholder advisory committee gets together. It should not be part of the technical work group conversation, especially when they haven't chosen to have an economist at the table.
Okay, if there are concerned citizens, I believe around the state of Oregon, on these issues that this work group is taking up, what do you think concerned citizens should be doing right now around this?
Concerned citizens, I think the best can be paying attention to their individual community leaders who are. We have a lot of representatives in this room that represent a lot of people. This morning, 14 member organizations signed on to a letter actually asking DEQ to issue a moratorium on all air permit renewals. And those 14 organizations are also the people who are well represented sitting through these meetings. So I think the concerned citizens who are not necessarily already connected with an organization would do best to find their neighbors and friends who are represented by East Side Portland Air Coalition, who are represented by Neighbors for Clean Air, who are represented by North Portland Air Quality, South Portland, Corvallis is here, the DALV. You know, there are many groups now that are really creating the structure to be able to provide their individual constituents and neighbors with better information about what's going on and help them add their voice to it. So that is going to be in the case of comments. There is public comment prescribed for each of these meeting schedules. And it's also going to be, sending those comments on to your state representatives, to the governor, to other decision makers who need to also be tracking this process and keeping a very close eye on how DEQ is moving forward. It is critical for DEQ to be taking the widest scope look at what can be done. So we're concerned about some of the guardrails they've already put on this. But we're also concerned because this full work group never started out with, I think, an objective and honest evaluation of where they are today. We spent half the day listening to very polished presentations about all the work that the state, whether it was OHA or the Department of Environmental Quality, has done on the air toxics issue to date. And I really felt like it was missing an honest evaluation about where it has failed. And I'm concerned that if the agency is not yet today able to be honest about its capabilities, I'm concerned about it being open to any new and improved programs and regulations that are going to really still require a lot of subjective implementation that is really the culture has to change at that agency, and we're still not seeing it in the way that they are even reflecting on their current status quo.
All right, Mary Pivoteau, East Side Air Coalition, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Columbia Riverkeeper has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to end uncontrolled toxic oil pollution at the Grand Coulee Dam. The group claims that the Grand Coulee has been leaking oil into the Columbia River for 70 years, endangering public health and threatening fish and wildlife. The suit is intended to bring the dam into compliance with the Clean Water Act by replacing toxic oils used at Grand Coulee with eco-friendly lubricants. In 2014, Columbia River Keepers settled a similar lawsuit against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers aimed at oil pollution from 8 dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers.
A 5-week series of public hearings to determine the path forward on the Vancouver Oil Terminal began on Monday. The hearings pit Vancouver Energy, a joint venture between Tesoro Corporation and the Savage Company, against a broad coalition of opponents. KBOO's Ray Bodwell had a chance to speak with Kristen Boyles, a staff lawyer for Earth Justice.
I work for an environmental law firm that's called Earth Justice. Our mission is to do environmental litigation for free for public interest community groups, citizen groups, environmental groups, in the kind of issues that we're talking about here, which is crude by rail oil terminals. In this proceeding, we represent a group of 8 environmental and local community groups. They are both really quite local. The Fruit Valley Neighborhood Association is right next door to to the proposed terminal site here in Vancouver, Washington. There to more regional groups like Columbia Riverkeeper and Friends of the Columbia Gorge, and then national groups like Sierra Club.
The hearings are being held by the Washington Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council. I guess my first question around that, is this an open to the public hearing? Is this more of a closed event? Maybe you could just give me a little bit of background about the hearings itself and your role in them.
This is a very unique proceeding. Washington State has a council, as you mentioned, called the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, that is a statewide agency that looks at big energy projects. They are open to the public. The proceedings are open to the public, and they're run like a trial. It's run by the rules of evidence, and there are questions from the council members as if they were sort of the judges. It's presented by the applicant, Tesoro Savage, putting on witnesses, information about how they're going to run the terminal, what their proposed safety measures are, et cetera, like that. And then with cross-examination from the opposing parties, questioning those witnesses.
That doesn't sound to me like someone could just walk up to the hearings and say, I want to make a point.
It's like a trial. The public can come and attend. There's lots of seats in the back. But it is not, you have to be a party and represented by legal counsel. And the witnesses are mostly experts on their particular fields, whether it's marine transportation or air impacts or health, those kind of things.
It seems like that there's, if you will, on the fore side, would appear to be obviously Vancouver Energy, which is the joint venture of Tesoro and Savage. And it appears that the Port of Vancouver itself is also in favor. The list of if you will, public agencies, organizations like yourself and so on that's against is enormous. What's the path forward here in terms of the decision-making apparatus? Who makes the decision and how is that done?
After the trial phase is done and all the evidence is in the record, the council members, there are 9 members on the FSEC council, they will make a recommendation, a written decision, either recommending that the site, that the application go forward, so it's sort of an approval, recommending that it go forward with changes, they can amend the application, or recommending denial. Once that recommendation is issued, then it goes, the final decision is made by the governor of the state of Washington. Then, if there are the party who's unhappy with that decision, and undoubtedly one side will be unhappy with that decision, that can be appealed directly to the Washington State Supreme Court. Your statement about the forces allied against the terminal proposal, it is a pretty impressive group that has come out to say that this is a bad idea for the state of Washington. The Mosier accident is a lot on people's minds. There will be evidence about that accident that will be presented in the second half when the opponents are doing their presentation of evidence. And there are witnesses that are going to talk about that in particular. But it's already been discussed. You can't have such a horrific accident only 70 miles upstream in the middle of the Columbia River Gorge when you're talking about putting another terminal here and not have it be really central in people's minds. So, yeah.
The first ever Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair opens at the fairgrounds in Salem this August. Here to talk about it with us is Peggy Anderson with the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair and Don Morse, chairman of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks
for having us.
So let's put it on the table. Is this basically a state fair for pot?
Pretty much. It's a growers fair. The focus here is on seed through harvest and what it takes. We're trying to bring together all the necessary people, lighting companies and irrigation companies, contractors, soil companies, you name it, and bring them together. And hopefully we can answer questions for growers and wannabe growers. We've involved the OLCC to give the updates on what's happening there. We've involved the Oregon Energy Trust, who will be helping growers with ways to save money on their energy bill. Trying to bring everyone together.
So this will cover the whole spectrum of growing indoor, outdoor, hydroponic, organic. Will it also, is it specifically for commercial growers, or is it also for home growers as well?
Home growers as well. We're hoping to get a lot of people, just regular consumers or people who are curious to come on in, spend an afternoon with us and see what the industry's about.
And is there anything else you'd want to say about why you created this event?
Well, I think it's very much needed. We needed to focus on growers and what they go through to bring this newest farm crop to market. One of the ways we're acknowledging that is by having the first ever live plant judging contest. And this will be, for legal reasons, it'll be for non-flowering plants only, up to 5 feet in size. And we're hoping many growers will bring in their best strains for judging. We've been very fortunate to sign Ed Rosenthal, the guru of ganja. He's written many books on the subject. He will be the head judge. And so I think it's going to be a great event and should generate a lot of enthusiasm and activity within the community.
So this is really interesting then. If it is limited to non-flowering plants, what are the criteria that you're using to judge based on?
Peggy?
We're judging on color, shape, structure, node spacing, leaf structure, aroma, and general health. And the top nine plants that win or judge as winners will go to the Oregon State Fair 2 weeks later, where we will have one crowned as the cannabis plant of 2016, kind of like the 4-H brand.
And will there be specific categories, or will there just be one general category?
There are three categories for entry: sativa, indica, and hybrid. And there'll be obviously three winners for second and third place in each category. The plants, the winning nine plants, go to the actual state fair, where the Oregon Cannabis Business Council will once again have a booth there. And this year, the 250,000 people that come through the state fair will be able to go through a greenhouse, as long as they're over the age of 21, and view the award-winning plants. And our purpose there is to educate the general public about what cannabis is all about now that it's a farming crop, and how it goes from being a seed all the way to harvest and sale in a dispensary. We're not there to sell cannabis or push its use. We're just there to inform the public and dispel rumors or misinformation.
When you were trying to put this together, did you run into any opposition? Did you have a hard time putting this together, or was everyone fairly receptive to the idea?
Well, this is our second year at the state fair. It's the first year for the growers' fair. And it took a bit of convincing that, we were going to take the high road on this and not there wouldn't be any problems and convince them to allow this. It certainly helped that the legislature declared this a farm crop this year. That was a big plus.
Mm-hmm. So we're kind of circling around this idea of kind of changing the maybe changing the image people have of mm-hmm. marijuana. Can you talk about how that is shifting?
Well, people are seeing it sold now through dispensaries and being raised in the countryside or perhaps even in their neighborhood, and they've realized the sky isn't falling. So people are becoming more accepting of it. They are now seeing the tremendous revenue raised through the tax system on cannabis. And I think this has only got positive things for Oregon in the future. And so it's becoming much easier. And by taking it to the state fairgrounds in a show for growers, and then or the general public to visit that, and then taking it to the actual state fair is really making it mainstream. I mean, people don't have to fear it anymore. It really helps to remove the stigma that's been associated with cannabis for the last 50 or 70 years.
To that end, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to mention, too, that since Oregon passed to legalize the medical marijuana, And then now the recreational, it's more of an education opportunity for this fair to inform people about the benefits. Better than drinking at the end of the day a cocktail or happy hour, maybe you do a little vape stick or a little edible or something like that and relax that way. So,
well, on the subject of sort of normalizing it in the public's mind, when you go to the state fair, will it be displayed and presented right alongside all of the other agricultural products?
Well, like I said, at the Growers Fair, you have to be 21 to enter, and then it's pretty visible within the building. There's no attempt to hide it. At the actual state fair, the 9 winning plants will be in a greenhouse, and access to view that will be 21 and over only.
That's interesting that they would make it age restricted when presumably hops is not judged or is not restricted in the same fashion. Do you think that will change over time?
Perhaps. I mean, you know, you can go with your child into a liquor store while they're pouring little Dixie cup samples of liquor. It may change over time, but for right now, we're willing to respect the government and agencies, people like the governing body of the state fair, that are allowing us this much latitude, and we're deeply appreciative of it.
And we needed to do the baby steps, and it will grow going forward, I have no doubt.
Are there any major sponsors for this event that you'd like to point out and call attention to?
Definitely. Club Sky High, a dispensary, garden supply store, and they're vertical as well. They grow their own. Over in St. John's, we have Savant. We have Sierra Bags, which is the exit bag, childproof bags. Steve Barrows has done an unbelievable job bringing this new product to market and has a patent. So they just released that actually last week. And we also have Rick's custom fencing, because if you do get into the commercial growing, you're going to need fencing. So opportunity there.
We were talking about it before we went on the air, but I want to raise it again. Why was the decision made to hold this in Salem as opposed to someplace with a larger population like Portland?
Well, there are a significant number of growers in Southern Oregon, and we felt it was necessary to go a little further south. Furthermore, having it at the state fair, being that it's now a farm crop, I think having it at the state fair underscores that fact. And, you know, we're trying to make a statement.
Okay, we have a little over a minute left. Are there any other events or activities at either the State Fair or the Growers Fair that you would want to let listeners know about or highlight?
I think it's more education. We're not going to have any, you know, games or anything like that. We do have some dispensaries that will be there. Dispensaries are free to get in. They just need to contact myself at the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair website. There's a contact there.
I'd like to make mention, too, that in both cases, obviously the state fair itself, but also the growers' fair, that no cannabis will be given away. There's no consumption on premise, etc. This isn't your cup, you know, that some people may be used to where you're enjoying cannabis at the time. This is strictly educational. It's business to business, consumer to business, to find out what there is, how to grow, what resources are available to you.
Well, speaking of resources, if are there any resources available for the listeners out there if they want to check it out, learn more about these two events, and maybe even support the events?
Right. They go to the OregonCannabisGrowersFair.com. There are tickets available. They're $20. And if anybody's interested in submitting a plant in the sativa, hybrid, or indica strains, that's also listed on the site as well. You must have a patient or a grower's number card.
And if anyone wants information on the Oregon Cannabis Business Council, you can go to OregonCBC.com and find out more about us and our main mission, which is to bring cannabis to the public in a safe and socially responsible manner.
Well, thank you both, Peggy and Don, for joining us today. I expect that you will have a pretty good turnout for this event this summer, and I wish you continued success in the future. We were joined today by Peggy Anderson and Don Morse. They're speaking to us today about the Oregon State Cannabis Growers Fair. As a reminder, you must be over 21 to attend, and the event will be August 13th and 14th at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. The website is www.OregonCannabisGrowersFair.com.
A report released today by the Oregon Center for Public Policy shows corporate income taxes are at their lowest rate in decades in Oregon. The decline in corporate tax rates has led to a gap in funding for schools and other state services. KBOO's Jemani Ward-Lewis, in partnership with the Oregon News Service, has this report.
The share of taxes Oregon collects from corporations has dropped significantly over the last four decades. According to a report released today by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, the corporate share of income taxes in the mid-70s was more than 18%, but today it's less than 7%. Juan Carlos Ordonez, Communications Director for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, says the state has not yet come up with a way to fill the budget hole left by lower taxes on corporations.
Oregon has one of the nation's most crowded classrooms, shorter school years, and there's a great deal of need. And it's certainly, to some extent, the burden being shifted to families and individuals, but also just the hole not being filled.
Ordonez says a number of policies have led to the sharp decline in taxes collected from corporations. For instance, the report says before 1980, there were 9 federal and state tax breaks available for corporations. Today, there are 51. The tax rate for corporations could change this November, however. On this year's ballot is the Business Tax Increase Initiative, which would raise the rate to 2.5% on corporations with incomes that exceed $25 million per year. According to Oregon's Legislative Revenue Office, the measure would net the state $3 billion a year. Ordonez says that money would be a much-needed windfall for Oregon underfunded state services.
It would go a long way in filling the needs of our K-12 schools and putting in resources to work for addressing the needs of our seniors and other important needs for our state.
The report cites two different studies that show Oregon has the lowest effective tax rate in the country for businesses. For KBOO News, I'm Jemani Ward-Lewis.
Volkswagen has agreed to pay up to $14.7 billion to settle claims in the United States resulting from their deliberate cheating on U.S. auto emission tests. In addition to buying back as many as 475,000 VWs and Audi diesels that do not comply with U.S. emission standards, they will put $2.7 billion into a government fund to compensate for the environmental impact of those cars. They will also pay $2 billion towards cleaner vehicle projects such as charging stations for electric cars. In a separate agreement, VW has also announced settlements with 44 U.S. states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico that will cost the company an additional $600 million. Under that agreement, Oregon will receive about $85 million. About $68 million will be used to establish a special fund aimed at reducing diesel emissions in the state. The balance of $17 million will be paid to the state for violating consumer protection laws.
As California goes, so goes the nation. This November, voters in America's most populous state will decide if their state will legalize recreational marijuana. The initiative would allow adults aged 21 and older to possess, transport, and purchase up to an ounce of marijuana and grow up to 6 plants for recreational use. If the initiative is approved, local and state law enforcement could save over $100 million annually, while tax revenue could exceed $1 billion. Measure supporters have raised over $3.5 million, more than 30 times what opponents have raised. Voters rejected a similar measure, Proposition 19, by a narrow margin in 2010. In 1996, California was the first state to legalize marijuana for medical use.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News from the VOO at 5:45, followed by Love and Revolution at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be sunny and close to 80 degrees. Today in history, in 2006, the Supreme Court ruled 5-3 that President George W. Bush's plans to try Guantanamo Bay detainees in military tribunals violated U.S. and international law. Our quote of the day is from former President Jimmy Carter, who said, "What has happened at Guantanamo Bay does not represent the will of the American people. I'm embarrassed about it. I think it's wrong. I think it does give terrorists an unwarranted excuse to use the despicable means to hurt innocent people."
It's 5:31, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Attention, people. There's big news out of Washington. Representative Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, has announced that he has an idea. This is news because the GOP leadership has not offered an idea in years. Instead, they've simply been the party of no, opposing all proposals put forward by Democrats and nixing everything that big majorities of us commoners want Congress to act on, like a jobs program to repair America's collapsing infrastructure and raising the minimum wage above the poverty level. So we were excited when Speaker Ryan called a major press conference to present his idea for fixing the economy. But sheesh, it's a rehash of the same old stale idea the GOP has for every issue. The elimination of government protections for consumers, workers, our environment, and so forth, so corporate profiteers can run roughshod over us. That's the sole idea in the highly hyped 57-page economic agenda that Ryan is peddling like a snake oil salesman. His fix is to roll back hundreds of important regulations that restrain corporate rapaciousness. For example, he wants to free Wall Street bankers, for-profit colleges, cable giants, and others from rules that prevent them from ripping off and otherwise harming consumers. His plan also repeals, quote, all climate change regulations under the Clean Air Act, a sweet favor for big coal and electric utilities. Ryan would even cancel ethics rules that require retirement advisors to act in their clients' best interests rather than taking kickbacks for persuading clients to put their savings in bad investments. This is Jim Hightower saying, by calling these rank corporate giveaways, quote, an economic agenda, Ryan himself is committing a shameful, immoral fraud against the American people. His plan would fix our economy in the same way a veterinarian fixes your dog.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
David Cameron's final supper meeting with EU ministers featured quail salad, green beans, and poached veal, tactfully avoiding crow and chicken. The mood was good-tempered, the jibes few and far between, the atmosphere sober except for the occasional laugh. Mr. Cameron made it clear before the meeting that his successor would have to pull the Brexit trigger, invoking EU's Article 50. He plans to quit as Prime Minister by October at the latest. After the meeting, one Northern European leader remarked that given the circumstances, it could have been far worse, saying, "But only nice things can be said about the dead."
With Brexit making the global and U.S. economies even more chaotic, Dan Raphael's Poetic Justice brings you some rhyming observations.
Brexit, Texit, tell me where's the exit? As the world around us falls apart, how will all the pieces fit? The banks act like austerity is not just another word for poverty. High interest rates to them are great, but for most of us it's a form of robbery. Doesn't matter if you're right or left when there's no jobs or affordable housing. The rich man's media turns poor against poor while politicians inflame with their mouthings. Could be blood on the street, but not on the streets that limos drive on. It's workers' inability to find common ground that continues the chaos money thrives on. With false claims and distraction, the rich dissipate our actions. With power comes invulnerability. They don't see or hear folks like you and me. There's no single answer. There's so much to repair in patience, vision, community, for human and earth justice everywhere. This is Dan Raphael with Poetic Justice.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The bottom line is, if they don't work for working people, we will mobilize to defeat them.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka on U.S. global trade deals. He was speaking at the AFL-CIO's Global Trade Conference at the Labor Federation's Washington, D.C. headquarters Tuesday. Trumka and the labor movement are not against trade. They just want trade deals and trade policies that benefit working people instead of tearing down our wages and shipping our good jobs overseas.
We need a different trade model, not crumbs off the table of big corporations who are the only winners in the failed NAFTA model. the TPP must be renegotiated or scrapped entirely.
Ohio Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown says U.S. trade policies hurt rather than help working people and our economy while further enriching the 1%.
It gives too much power and money to multinational corporations and to the 1%. It doesn't grow the middle class. It doesn't build an economy from the middle out as we should.
Federal appeals court rulings giving the National Labor Relations Board authority over tribal casinos on Indian land in Michigan will stand. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided not to hear an appeal of those federal court rulings. The tribal casino industry generates approximately $28.5 billion a year, according to the National Indian Gaming Commission. The decision by the High Court not to intervene in this case is likely to make it easier for workers and their unions to organize tribal casinos. The GOP-controlled U.S. House has passed a bill taking away the NLRB's authority over tribal businesses on Indian land, but it has not yet passed the Senate. More than 3,000 union nurses at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston will decide whether or not to ratify a tentative new labor agreement that was reached with the help of a federal mediator. The Massachusetts Nurses Association says it's a huge victory for the nurses. A strike was avoided by the tentative agreement. MNA says the agreement provides better staffing policies and what the union says are fair wages and health benefits, in addition to addressing nurse safety on the job.
Brought to you by Union Active, affordable, state-of-the-art web design using responsive web technology with easy-to-use content tools, member management features, and a host of other tools that make Union Active your perfect web solution. Designs, prices, and features are online at unionactive.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making good on promises to take their demand for a vote on gun control back to their districts, House Democrats convene public events across the country today in what they call a National Day of Action on Gun Violence Prevention. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
House Democrats went home for the July 4th recess and quickly began to engage their constituents on gun violence. At public discussions, press conferences, and rallies around the country Wednesday, they continued the call for a vote in the U.S. House on what they say are common-sense gun laws. In Chicago, Illinois Democrat Danny Davis addressed a crowd early Wednesday, surrounded by people waving signs that read "Disarm Hate" and "Moms Demand Action." Davis echoed the message Democrats across the country are taking to the streets.
We're simply saying to our Republican colleagues, to our speaker, our neighbor from Wisconsin, put it on the floor, give us a vote, and we will reflect what the American people want, and that is sensible, sane, rational, logical gun control.
Democrats want the GOP leadership in the U.S. House to allow a full vote on a number of gun control bills, including one calling for universal background checks that would close the so-called gun show loophole, and a no-fly, no-buy measure that would block anyone identified by the FBI as a potential terrorist from buying firearms. NRA-funded Republicans largely oppose expanded background checks and are joined in opposition to no-fly, no-buy laws by civil libertarians who are concerned about due process for those included on such lists. At a roundtable held by Massachusetts-based gun control advocacy group Stop Gun Violence, one mother, Ramona, described the day her son was shot and killed.
So Anthony tried to get up and shot him in the back and killed him instantly.
The nationwide series of events follows last week's 26-hour sit-in at the U.S. Capitol, led by civil rights veteran and Georgia Representative John Lewis, during which lawmakers all but shut down the U.S. House of Representatives. Only one vote was held in the waning days of the session before House Speaker, Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, recessed early, sending lawmakers home ahead of schedule. The one vote that Speaker Ryan did push through during the sit-in was a $1.1 billion GOP-backed Zika bill that includes provisions to cut funding for Planned Parenthood and eases restrictions on pesticides. The Zika bill made its way to the U.S. Senate this week, but was stopped in its tracks by Democrats who say they were locked out of negotiations on the measure. Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell has pledged to bring the Zika bill back for another vote when the legislature reconvenes, and House Democrats vow to continue their demand for votes on gun control. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
You are listening to the Cable Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, John Pacheco, Dan Raphael, and Jemani Ward-Lewis. Our producer is Theo Burke. Special thanks to Oregon News Service, Free Speech Radio News, and to producer Theo Burke, who provided the live piano during the news. Our public affairs director is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is David Kesters. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Bobin Singh from the Oregon Justice Resource Center and Ashley Nellis with the Sentencing Project about the report The Color of Justice, Racial and Ethnic Disparities in State Prisons. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Chilean writer Lina Merwene about Seeing Red, her intense, visceral novel about the relationship between the body, illness, and human relationships. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.